loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. The Trump administration announced its nuclear posture review, which calls for a major upgrade in the U.S. nuclear arsenal, including more new nuclear weapons and smaller tactical nukes that could be used on a battlefield. The policy is a violation of a long-standing international agreement and could lead to a new arms race. Days after the release of the so-called Nunes memo, the Democrats are insisting on the release of their memo, which might be considered a minority rebuttal. But it's time to take a look at the big picture. What does this whole incident say about the FBI, about its power, its capacity for abuse and misconduct, and the history of an organization that has played such a decisive role in American politics over many, many decades?
And in our second hour, we talk about the five big stories of the day. First, a Russian warplane was shot down over Syria on Saturday, killing the pilot. The surface-to-air missile was fired by Al-Qaeda rebels, a dangerous development as the Trump administration brags that it has defeated ISIS in Syria. Next, today marks the 15th anniversary of the speech by then-Secretary of State Colin Powell to the United Nations Security Council that laid out the U.S. path to war against Iraq. Powell had told the UN definitively that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. That was not true, and the lie led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. Then, again this week, we'll look at the worst and most misleading headlines. And then we're going to talk about the latest news of the day regarding the so-called Nunes memo, the Democrats' minority memo, and a recently declassified referral from the Senate Judiciary Committee about a criminal accusation against Christopher Steele, the author of the now infamous Steele dossier. And finally, in a setback for leftist former President Rafael Correa, the Yes campaign succeeded on all questions in yesterday's referendum in Ecuador, pushed by current President Lenin Moreno, who is accused of betraying the citizens' revolution movement that brought him to power. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the new nuclear posture review adopted by the Trump administration. We're joined from New Mexico by Greg Mello. He is the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. And we're joined in the studio by Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Welcome, Greg and Kevin.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Greg Mello, you are here in Washington, D.C., trying to have some input before the nuclear posture review was announced. Now that it has been, what's your take?
Well, it's a very bellicose document, and it's one that will make the United States less secure. It applies the wrong remedies to declining U.S. sway in the world, and it could lower the threshold to nuclear use. It's not in its bones, it's not that different from what's been before, but the rhetoric is terrible. The two new weapons are symbolic and also embody this idea that the United States could use nuclear weapons to prevail in conflicts around the world. So that's it's terrible.
Kevin Camps, we had Mutual Assured Destruction, a proper acronym, MAD, guaranteeing all parties in the case of a nuclear war that each and all would be destroyed, and that became a deterrent. Is this nuclear posture review taking a step away from mutual assured destruction? In other words, the winnability idea of a nuclear war?
Yes, I think so. There's talk of low-yield weapons to achieve limited aims. So it is really blurring distinctions between conventional military and nuclear military, unfortunately. There's explicit language along those lines. And something that's really alarming is the expansion of nuclear weapons use by the United States in response to non-nuclear attacks. So, for example, in the New York Times coverage, they point to a couple examples. One is an attack on the electric grid, which, yes, is very serious. I work mostly on nuclear power issues, and you lose the electric grid and you are down the road to meltdown and even pool fire. It's a very serious thing. But Also, another example given was the loss of the cell phone communications in this country. So to threaten to use nuclear weapons in response to loss of the cell phone infrastructure in this country is a real expansion of their use. So Strangelovian is a word I'm hearing a lot of.
Kevin Kemps, I have to ask you a quick question, too. Is there really such a thing as a low-yield nuclear weapon?
Well, there's certainly different scales of nuclear weapons.
Sure, isn't fallout, no matter how small you try to make the yield, it's still radioactive.
And
isn't that right?
George Shultz just made that point in his response to this nuclear posture review. A nuclear weapon is a nuclear weapon, and don't mess with that distinction. So messing with it is a very dangerous thing to do to begin with.
That seems like the logical thing to me.
Yeah, Greg Mello, you're an expert on this. Go ahead.
Well, I think it may seem like a nuance, but I think it's quite important to note that a lot of what is in this review has already been U.S. policy for a long time. It just wasn't emphasized. So mutual assured destruction was not the idea behind a lot of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. That was kind of a myth that was out there. Really, all the while, people have been beavering for decades trying to figure out how to win nuclear wars, and that is how our arsenal is structured. There's always been the threat to use nuclear weapons in response to, say, a cyber attack on the grid. All of that was there under Obama, and it just wasn't emphasized as much. But it was discussed a lot, really, and that is what we mean by not forswearing a first strike with nuclear weapons. There's always some reason to have a first strike. Well, it's either a non-nuclear perceived attack on the United States or, more likely, a potential defeat of U.S. forces abroad somewhere. So the idea that we would use nuclear weapons first in a conflict or because of some other circumstance has a lot of detail behind it that's always been there. And so I'm a little concerned right now that a lot of the people who are most critical of the Trump nuclear posture review were actually in favor of the same policy. This is not going to apply to Kevin, of course, but former officials who are critical of the Trump nuclear posture review were actually in favor of most of those policies in the recent past.
Well, that's an important point. How much is continuity? How much is real change? Certainly the Democratic Party or the Democratic Party elites in Washington or the media that sort of function as an echo chamber for them are making a great deal out of the unusualness of Donald Trump, the person, and you can't overstate that, really.
I'd like to take an example of the long-range standoff weapon, which Obama green-lighted. Well, it's a very destabilizing cruise missile, be stealthy, could reach anywhere, say, in the Soviet Union, anywhere in Eurasia. When fired from bombers, which... Stand off the enemy boundaries, and they're not counted under the New START treaty because a bomber counts as only one warhead. A B-52 can carry 20 of these. So, and Obama cleared the way for this, eliminated his appointee, who had been fighting against this program. And there's been a groundswell of, you might say, a neoconservative, pro-nuclear push that started three or four years ago.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, just to emphasize that this should not be a partisan discussion in any way in this country, Dan Ellsberg's Service to the World, actually, his new book, The Doomsday Machine, has examples of near misses with nuclear war that I didn't even know about, and I study this stuff. So, for example, an example was given of Carter administration, late 1970s, Soviet threat to invade the Persian Gulf, and the Carter administration's secretive response that I didn't find out about until I read this book recently was full-on nuclear war. And so that was a close call that I didn't even know about under a Democratic administration. Another example that Ellsberg gave was the Cuban Missile Crisis that many folks have heard about, even young people these days. But what was not known under this Democratic administration, the Kennedy administration, was how close it came in any number of ways. And a new story that I hadn't before encountered was Ellsberg's description of what if the U.S. had invaded Cuba militarily, conventionally, trying to, you know, take control of the situation. Well, what the Kennedy administration didn't know was that the Soviets, with their nuclear missiles already in place on the island, also had tactical nuclear weapons in place on the island of Cuba. And if the U.S. military had tried to invade, it would have been met with tactical nuclear explosions to take out their invasion force. So we've come so close under both Republican and Democratic administrations. And the real lesson is we have to abolish these things or they're going to abolish us. That was a point that was made during the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony just last 2 months ago now in December by Beatrice Finn, who said, the time is up. We need to abolish these weapons.
As Greg Mello said, the Navy, according to the Washington Post here, I'm looking at the editorial, the Navy already is designing a new fleet of a dozen ballistic missile submarines, the Columbia class. The Air Force wants a new long-range strategic bomber, the B-21 Raider, as well as new long-range cruise missile and replacements for existing land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles. When I read some of the documents and some of the literature, Greg, it seems to me, and of course I am no expert at all, not even slightly, on this subject, but when I read the documents, it makes me feel that the United States is really preparing for the possibility of a war with a major power, not simply using low-yield nuclear weapons in a battlefield situation where in the past they might have used conventional weapons against a minor, so-called minor enemy, meaning a much weaker adversary. But when you look at what the United States is doing, preparing its new contingency plans and new nuclear updates, when you look at what Russia is doing, when you look at what China is doing in particular, you can't but be left with the impression that all of these powers are really preparing for the possibility within a few decades of another major global type confrontation. Do you read it that way?
Well, in a way, yes. And integrating your question with the revelations that Kevin was talking about, and there are others, of course, over in Okinawa, the order came to launch nuclear weapons, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And one of the commanders of the base sent someone down to the missile launch area with a handgun to shoot anyone who tried to launch one, even though there had already been an order to launch that was initiated down at a lower level. So, yes, there have been terrible close calls. What I think that the lesson that I'm drawing from this conversation and from these circumstances is that the experts, say the experts in the Obama administration, I think there's a misplaced notion that this is all under control. And both in the micro sense, that each crisis is subject to control, and also in the macro sense, that the entire system of bureaucracies, the thing that funds itself, that uses fear and stampedes Congress to build new weapon systems, that all of that is somehow under expert control. And it's really not. So I'm hoping that some of the ex-administration officials and some of those who are really in have 1 foot or 2 feet in American foreign policy elite will draw from the present situation we find ourselves in and say, you know what, this is a hell of a lot more dangerous than we ever thought.
And let's talk about what happened in Hawaii. It turns out that 38 minutes, that terrifying 38 minutes where people in Hawaii were saying their last goodbyes to their children and rushing for whatever possible cover there might be because they had gotten all on their cell phones a text message that said, this is not a drill, incoming nuclear missile. And that's, of course, in the context of the U.S. DPRK confrontational stage that that exists right now. That person who sent the text actually thought there was an incoming missile. In other words, a nuclear attack was underway. It wasn't just a mistaken, like, this was supposed to be a drill but wasn't. I mean, it shows the human element is so dynamic. You know, the old cliche, no battle plan survives the first engagement with the enemy. Well, that goes even before the first battle, perhaps. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, I mean, it's a minor example, but even in the nuclear posture review document, there are errors. You can see typos where there's an extra space. And one of the bigger ones was they accidentally labeled Taiwan as China on a map and had to withdraw the document from the Pentagon website for a number of hours to fix that. And those are, you know, somewhat humorous examples of humans making mistakes that have to be fixed, but sometimes the mistake cannot be fixed. Greg gave the example from Okinawa. Then there's the example from the Soviet Union where, thankfully, a nuclear missileer commander realized, had a gut reaction that there was a glitch. There was not a U.S. attack underway with a half dozen or so nuclear weapons inbound towards Moscow and didn't elevate, you know, the response up the command chain. Knew there was a problem, took action decisively. So, you know, it's not just Beatrice Finn from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons calling for abolition. It's folks like Henry Kissinger years ago now in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal who said, if we don't eliminate these weapons, it's a huge threat to the United States, to our security. And that's pretty ironic coming from him because he depended on that tool for decades as a leader at the highest levels of our foreign policy in this country. But even he sees that this is going to come back to haunt United States security. It is the threat that could wipe us out. There's only one of those, and that's nuclear weapons.
Go ahead, Greg.
Well, I would like to even go a little bit broader, totally in agreement with Kevin there. But what was interesting about the Russian case that he just mentioned, and I can't remember the man's name, Kevin probably does, he thought about the context. So every day, you know, the people who are, you know, on our side, the Russian side, they are apprised of the context. And it's in that context of that they evaluate these threats. So he said, no, this is not, we're not about to go to war with the United States. I judge this to be a false alarm. And so, but if we are constantly confronting, constantly threatening, and the gentleman in Hawaii looked at the context, and the context affected him, perhaps, you know, more than it should have. He said, "This is real," and so that overall militarization of our foreign relations, the sense that we are at war all the time in one way or another, that will eventually lead to a nuclear war. We have to. While at the same time, it destroys the country like any other kind of addiction.
Yeah, the individual's name from the Soviet military was Stanislav Petrov. I want to read to you a little bit about what happened because context there was important. He got the report that he's called the man who single-handedly saved the world from nuclear war. And as we know from Daniel Ellsberg's excellent book, The Doomsday Machine, we're talking about the deaths automatically of hundreds of millions of people. I mean, a carnage and a holocaust and a genocide beyond anything that the human race has ever experienced. This is what happened on September 26, 1983, just 3 weeks after the Soviets shot down Korean airliner 007, the Korean civilian airliner that the Soviets mistook to be a U.S. intelligence plane, or maybe it was both, we don't know. But the Soviets shot it down. There was a real war hysteria in the United States. Gromyko, the foreign minister of the Soviet Union, wasn't allowed, or I think they were going to revoke his ability to land in New York City airports to come to the General Assembly in September 1983. There was a great war fever. This was 3 weeks later. Petrov, the duty officer at the command center for the OCO nuclear early warning system, has a report that 3 to 5 nuclear incoming missiles are heading towards the Soviet Union. And thus, the protocol is for him to launch, right? That's the protocol. But he, even in that sort of souped up, hyped up atmosphere 3 weeks after the shootdown of KAL-007, uses his brain and says, no, my brain or my gut tell me this isn't real, this isn't happening. And so he defies the protocol at great risk, actually, because sure. If you don't follow orders in the military, you know, that's the death sentence you could be looking at. Anyway, these are real things, Kevin, and in a way, it doesn't seem real to people because it hasn't happened yet. You know, it's kind of like if you're in a car and you haven't had a car crash personally, you don't think of like the imminence of a car crash. But when it happens to you, then you never think about cars in the same way.
Well, what the...
That's a good example.
The Hawaii 38-minute of terror false alarm shows is something I grew up with. You know, I was born in 1969, and by the time I was in high school, I realized that a nuclear war would give me about 30 minutes notice. So I actually, in high school, was thinking about what will I do with my last 30 minutes, something that nobody, especially a 17-year-old, should have to think about. And you know, there's another Soviet man who single-handedly saved the world, and this was in October of 1962 in the Cuban Missile Crisis, a submarine commander whose sub was being attacked with explosives by U.S. warship, and he voted, no, we will not launch this nuclear-tipped torpedo that we have on board, which would have sparked an all-out nuclear war between the two
countries.
And
the Americans, I believe, didn't know that the Soviet subs actually had nuclear-tipped torpedoes. Is that correct?
That was the amazing thing about the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Kennedy administration, at the highest level, did not know that there were land-based nuclear weapons, including tactical and submarine-based nuclear torpedoes. And they were taking their actions in complete ignorance of that fact. That's how close we came.
Greg Mello, I want to turn real quickly. We're going to do another segment even later this week on our show about the standoff between the U.S. and North Korea. But it appears that there's a debate going on within the administration over whether or not to use the, quote, bloody nose strategy against North Korea. Perhaps the news articles are saying the White House, although it's not clear that that means Donald Trump, wants to keep open the option of a limited surgical strike against some part of the DPRK's nuclear facilities. Other people are saying that's just too crazy. With even just the conventional weapons that the DPRK has and have trained on Seoul, 30 miles from the DMZ, that millions of people would die like within the first 24 hours. Do you believe, Greg Mello, that there's a part of the Trump administration or a part of the Pentagon? The news articles are saying the Pentagon's not forwarding contingency plans to the White House because they don't want to like encourage them or make them think it's something's possible. Some parts of this establishment that are actually countenancing the idea that you can have a limited war with a nuclear power, which of course North Korea now is a nuclear power?
I'm afraid I do believe that. And it's somewhat reminiscent of things that happened during the Reagan administration when the uniformed military brought in a sense of realism about things which ideologues didn't have. And we saw this during the drafting of the NPR. As bad as it is, it started out much worse. It was really since the liberals are banished, it was the generals and budget hawks who reined in, really wild ideas. The original drafters of this were people who believed that a nuclear war could be waged and won against Russia. They are on record saying that with only 20 million casualties, the U.S. could be up and running again.
Yeah, Pat Buchanan used to say that at every available public opportunity. And certainly it's an argument that that Henry Kissinger used to make all the time. This has been a mainstream Republican policy position for many decades. And frankly, the left hasn't pushed back very hard on it, at least not the neoliberal pretend left.
Well, there's a famous book from the 1980s entitled With Enough Shovels, and it was an allusion to a statement made by a Reagan administration official that if we had enough shovels in the United States, everybody could dig their own bomb shelter, take a door off the house and put it over the top, and you got a bomb shelter. Of course, it's probably a grave. You've dug your own grave. You're probably going to die in there. So, yeah, this nightmare stuff goes back decades, and that's why I say—
Yes, and it— Go ahead, Pete.
Abolition is where it's at. That's— action needs to be taken by, you know, every man, woman, and child in this country to avert the worst.
Greg Mello, we're gonna give you the last word. We have about 90 seconds left. It seems to me that the grave danger here is that there's not a large mass anti-nuclear movement as did exist in the early 1980s. The Democrats and the Republicans are essentially in consensus with each other. And even if Trump leaves office and, I don't know, even a liberal Democrat takes office in 2020, the nuclear consensus continues. And thus, the dangers are grave. And in our last 60 seconds, what do we want to tell the population? What do we want to tell the people in Washington, D.C. and other cities who are listening to this show right now?
Write open letters to your congressional delegation, not private letters, open letters, and demand that they roll back these kind of policies and demand that they roll back the great power competition, which will sooner or later lead to a catastrophic war. We can't, I mean, far short of that, the country can't stand it. It's simple to do. Everyone at every level needs to look around and say, where are my political points of leverage and how can I use them? We need to sort of exercise those political muscles it could take 1,000 different forms.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from New Mexico by Greg Mello. He's the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group, and we've been joined here in studio in Washington, D.C. by Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. Is it beyondnuclear.org?
That's right.
Okay, for his website. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Days after the release of the so-called Nunes memo, the Democrats are insisting on the release of their memo, which might be considered a minority rebuttal. But it's time to take a look at the big picture. What does this whole incident say about the FBI, about its power, its capacity for abuse and misconduct, and the history of an organization that has played such a decisive role in American politics over many, many decades? We are joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Businessweek, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. And you can find his writings at thiscan'tbehappening.net. And we're joined by David Cobb. He is the campaign manager of the 2016 Jill Stein Ajamu Baraka presidential campaign and spokesperson for the organization Move to Amend. Welcome, Dave and David.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Dave and David, thanks for joining us. David Cobb, let's start with you. Of course, the media attention has been dominated by what the Nunes memo, so-called, shows and doesn't show about the FBI's application to the FISA court, the secret court that the FBI and other intelligence organizations routinely go to get permission from a court. It's not really a court because there's no adversarial proceeding there. It's pretty much of a rubber stamp. But about whether they denied giving the full information to the court, the FISA court, about the premise for their warrant for Carter Page, a volunteer Trump campaign, he says advisor, although the Trump campaign sort of has told him to cease and desist representing himself as such. But let's talk about maybe a bigger picture, which is both houses in Congress and both parties in Congress, the Democrats and Republicans, just authorized, including Devin Nunes, to give great power, to renew the great power of the FISA court and the intelligence agencies to get warrants to surveil against people in the United States. We're learning about Carter Page, but there's a lot more people and there's a lot of abuse. And It seems to me that that's the story that's not being told. Go ahead.
Well, Brian, I'm so glad you started us there. And as a refresher for some of your listeners and maybe just to contextualize it for others, remember that FISA stands for Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. This is a threat to has been acknowledged to be a threat to civil liberties since its first inception. And its reauthorization, as you correctly said, had 21 Democrats giving the Trump administration this authorization. And the new authorization, Section 702, explicitly authorizes warrantless searches of what we presume under our system to be law-abiding Americans. It allows for the collection of communications amongst entirely innocent Americans who even reference the wrong foreigner, and gives the Attorney General, that is Trump's Attorney General, unchecked power to decide when the government can use what it finds against us. I mean, this is, it's not only sweeping in its breadth, it is stunning in its depth. I mean, this in the midst of when the Democrats are claiming to be, quote, the resistance, are literally giving to the Trump administration and his Attorney General and this entire administration a level of access to information that, again, it's just stunning in its scope.
Yeah, I saw a poll, Dave Lindorf, which was not surprising, but really astonishing in one way. It said that it was from this weekend. 38% of Republicans have faith in the FBI. 38%.
Wow.
38% of Republicans.
That's dramatic.
And 62% of Democrats have faith in the FBI. So over the years, and since the Russian Revolution and the beginning of the raids against progressives and socialists, the Palmer raids in 1918, I mean, all the people on the left have always said, beware of the FBI. If they knock at your door, don't talk to them. They're up to no good. They're professional liars. They're coming to undermine the civil rights movement, the progressive movement, the peace movement, the women's movement. And guess what? That's what the FBI did. And now you have Republicans saying, we don't approve of the FBI. We doubt that it's capable to carry out anything legal in this case. But the Democrats, in other words, there's role reversal here. Go ahead, Dave Lindorf.
You're going to have to hold me back here. I mean, you know, the thing is that the media, the corporate media, have this line now, you know, well, this is such a scandal because the FBI has, you know, since its embarrassing days of COINTELPRO being exposed, has been working hard to rebuild its reputation. Let's just look at that for a minute. I remember reporting stories on how the FBI was completely violating the post-church rules by putting informants inside of anti-nuclear groups, inside of the their resistance to the in the U.S. to the Reagan program in El Salvador and the Contras, to I'm forgetting the name of the group, but CISPES, I guess it was
CISPES. And committee, you know, in solidarity with the people, yeah, of El Salvador.
Yeah. I remember them.
And, you know, and they infiltrated that. They took names of everybody that was participating, you know, on and on. The FBI has made a joke of any reforms that were supposedly put in place after the expose of COINTELPRO, and nothing changed. And not only that, but you know, in addition to the FISA court and the fact that, you know, as you say, it's really not only is it a rubber stamp, but I think even today that only a handful, maybe not even 10 requests yet in the history of the FISA court have been rejected by, you know, for requests for the right to surveil Americans.
Actually, and, Dave Lindorf, can I interrupt you on that point? Because I want to sort of amplify what you're saying on that specific point. In 2016, the FISA court received 1,485 requests for surveillance. 34 were rejected or denied.
Okay, my numbers are off, but it's so tiny.
Well, listen, this is what I want to prove. I want to add to what you were saying because I think you're right. I don't think your numbers are off. In 2014, there were 1,379. None were rejected. In 2015, 1,457, none were rejected. This is out-of-control organization.
That's right. So in other words, the whole argument that the Nunez memo makes, that, you know, that some information that was in the FBI's request for the surveillance was not complete or not, or didn't have context, is ridiculous because they didn't need it. All they'd have to do basically is say, we think this guy's Russian agent and he needs to be surveilled or whatever. And the FISA court's going to say yes. When are they going to say no? They never say no. So, you know, it's sort of a bogus argument. But the other thing I was going to say about the FBI is that in addition to all this other stuff, the FBI can do surveillance simply by having an FBI letter. And that's the worst of all. We had this happen with, our webmaster, our web server, mayfirst.org, was hit with an FBI letter and had their servers taken, and they weren't allowed to tell anybody about it. When you get an FBI letter, you can't even tell people that you're being under threat, even though they weren't being charged with anything. It involved a website in Greece that they were hosting that was being investigated.
So they took the server.
They took their servers.
How come they didn't take the DNC server?
Yeah.
Wait a second.
Good question.
Yeah, right.
Wait. James Comey said when he was testifying before Congress that he realized that it would be helpful to the forensic investigation to actually have the DNC server. But you know, again, when we go back to the whole Russiagate story, which, you know, we don't have to overdo it right now. But here you had Christopher Steele hired as opposition research to carry out, to get dirt on Donald Trump for first Republican rivals of Trump. And then it was picked up by the DNC. And he provides a lot of information to the FBI and also information about Carter Page's trip to Moscow in July, where he spoke at some kind of conference. All of that we know to be true, and yet the research opposition part of this hasn't really come through. And that's what Nunez is really making the point of, is that the FBI went to the FISA court and didn't indicate, one, that they were using research opposition paid for by Hillary Clinton, and they didn't also reveal to the FISA court that the Yahoo News story by Michael Isikoff, which was also about the same subject, was actually based also on information or leaks or an interview given to the Yahoo News by Christopher Steele himself. In other words, that it was very thin. Maybe there will be more that'll come out in terms of their other underlying sources. But let's go back. I want to just ask you, David Cobb, because the Republicans are making the claim that this proves that the FBI was going after Donald Trump. But Carter Page, when the FISA warrant was issued, was in the end of October 2016. He was no longer even a Trump volunteer. He had never met Donald Trump. He was trying to get in on the Trump campaign. But he's been under sort of FBI surveillance of one type or another, or U.S. government surveillance, for almost a decade. First reported because he was doing business in Turkmenistan, a former Soviet republic. And then the FBI interviewed him in 2013 and sort of warned him that he was the target of a Russian intelligence operation to try to recruit him as a spy. So he was warned about it. And he told the FBI purportedly, well, why don't you go focus more on the Boston Marathon and things like that, the Boston Marathon massacre or killing. It happened earlier than that. When you look at the whole thing, there's not much there except to come away with the idea that this is a corrupt system, and it's a corrupted system using FBI and FISA. And the Democrats are part of the corruption. The Republicans are part of the corruption. But I guess the Republicans never felt that it was going to be used against them. I mean, perhaps that's the big shocking, right, astonishing news for Devin Nunez.
I mean, I think that's right. And I really appreciate both David Lindorf and John and you, Brian, for really drilling down into what is actually happening here. I'm going to take the opportunity to step back again and really to to remind listeners who may, I mean, you know, we on the left know, oh, COINTELPRO is bad. But I want to remind people, because I actually did some research to remind myself, and I, who was already, I thought, aware, shocked how explicit it was. The creation of COINTELPRO was specifically designed, and now I will quote from the FBI, quote, to increase factionalism, cause disruption, and win defections inside the Communist Party, end quote. So let's remember, and you know, I'm a Green Party member, so as a political dissident on the left, this is of particular interest to me. This is not just a matter of trivia. The reality is the government authorized and, in fact, did use a systemic campaign to target both social movements and dissident political parties who were trying to use the electoral system to effect change. You know, the thing that they tell us in civics class that we're supposed to do. So this is the context that we're dealing with. And as John or Dave Lindorf laid out very quickly earlier, we have to remember that under COINTELPRO, we literally saw a systemic campaign against anything that was remotely considered of the left. So again, as you say, Brian, the only thing that's shocking now is that Republicans and the right are saying, oh, wait a minute, occasionally this might be turned somewhere against us, and now they are feigning shock and outrage. So, you know, again, look, this would actually be a really great comedic farce if it were Shakespearean, yeah. But because it's actual real life, it just shows how thoroughly and utterly corrupt this system really is.
John Kiriakou, the FBI has announced also that it's got a task force to counter foreign influence and disinformation plans. And as a consequence of this need to keep our country safe from the Russians.
Yes.
And especially from this station. And I'd say in particular from our show, that they're creating a task force to monitor social media.
Yeah, there's an article in The Nation magazine by Chip Gibbons, who's a regular guest on this show, saying exactly that the FBI is setting up a new task force that would have as its job, as its goal, only to monitor our social media. You know, there's another thing, too. The FBI, and I'm going to use as an example a case that was decided today in Canada, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, they work very, very closely together. The RCMP found two marginal people, kind of malcontents, not very bright, and the RCMP talked them into building pressure cooker bombs that they then placed in the British Columbia Regional Parliament. Okay, these were just losers who had nothing else to do, and it was the RCMP that actually built the bombs and had these people place them. The FBI does exactly the same kind of thing all the time. They entrap people all the time. That's what this is going to amount to. They're going to be reading people's Twitter feeds and Facebook posts and Instagram pictures, and they're going to find somebody who doesn't like the state of the economy or the government or feels cut out or cut off, and they're going to talk somebody into trying to do something stupid and maybe dangerous, and then point to these great successes that they have in counterterrorism. It's as though the government has just been slowly going crazy, and we've finally gotten to the point where, to me, it's a tipping point where we have to just say enough.
You know, the other thing that neither the Democrats or the Republicans complained about was how the FBI and local enforcement and private corporations working through what's called the fusion centers and organizations that were created after 9/11 to completely monitor the social media, every little social media post of all the political activists who were involved in the Occupy movement.
Let me give you a story on that.
Go ahead.
A personal story. When I got a document in 2012 from the from a law firm down in Washington,
Partnership for Civil Justice Fund.
Yeah, Partnership for Civil Justice. You know, they did a huge FOIA investigation into the Homeland Security and FBI actions around the Occupy movement. And one of the pages they found was a notice that went out to all the fusion centers at the time. I think there were 72 at that time, warning them that a small alternative news organization called This Can't Be Happening had published an article exposing the role of Homeland Security in coordinating the crackdown on the Occupy movement around the country. And they said, I loved this line, they said, fortunately, this information has remained compartmentalized in the alternative media, but we're alerting you to this threat in case it gets into the mainstream media. And this was from the Threat Assessment Office of Homeland Security in Washington. And So anyway, we put that on our masthead, the only news organization officially labeled a threat by Homeland Security, and it sits there now proudly. But, you know, this is what's going on. I actually had, you know, I mean, my experience was to have my own FBI file from my teenage days as a war resister in the 60s. And, you know, the FBI visited friends or colleagues of my father at the University of Connecticut asking about me and my activities and so on. And that was all during the COINTELPRO days.
David Cobb, you know, I want to go back to some of these documents again, because here you have 60 or 62% of Democrats supporting or approving of the FBI as a consequence of the Russiagate thing and the way that everyone's been taken in tow. In 2011, when the Occupy movement started, I saw those. I read the documents, the FOIA documents that the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund received from the government, and they showed that all of the government law enforcement and intelligence agencies, including the FBI, were monitoring everything everyone did in every state of the country, as if there was an enemy attack. Now, this was a peaceful protest movement. This was a movement that was protesting against the aggregation of extreme wealth amongst the 1%. But the FBI and the other intelligence agencies treated it like an enemy combatant. And they coordinated
it under terrorism. It was classed as a terrorism investigation.
Exactly. The fusion centers used their anti-terrorism authority and funding to carry this out. Now, that's why... David Cobb, I think this is critically important, the most critically important issue. If you have the progressive part of the population now under the umbrella or shadow of the Russia investigation, so-called, because there's been, as of now, even with Carter Page, he hasn't been arrested. There's no evidence from the Carter Page investigation that's been offered about actual collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. None whatsoever. But if under this shadow or this umbrella, the progressives are now embracing the Democrat, the FBI. What happened in 2011, or under James Comey, the targeting of the Black Lives Matter movement, which he called, or they called, the FBI under his leadership called Black Identity Extremists. We're in a situation where, of course, the right is not going to protect the left, and parts of the left are now saying the FBI is our friend. We've entered a whole new era that threatens dissent and civil liberties.
Aaron Brodbecker, for the first time, we've got something to disagree with, because you called members of the Democratic Party the left.
Okay, just for the record, I want to apologize.
Hey, Ross, I thought we would actually get a chance to disagree. But look, I'm being somewhat playful, but also to really get serious for a moment, like, that is the problem, isn't it? The reality is that what this is exposing is that anything that challenges the economic system, the class system of this country, will be targeted not just by the FBI, but by corporate media, by every institution that exists in this society, what Gramsci calls the hegemonic apparatus of how society and culture operates has been turned on us. I also want to remind you that when Peter Camejo ran for president first on the Socialist Workers Party, that we now know because of FOIA requests that over 3/4 of the people who were on his staff were actually paid FBI informants. I mean, again, like, this is like, it is a consistent, it's not just a pattern. It is literally the culture. It is the system. It is how it is utilized. Now,
you mean they were trying to interfere with the U.S. election process?
Yeah, how about that? And not to mention all the other interference in foreign elections that the United States government has done. The point I'm making is this. Our job, I believe, is to educate people who still have, how to say it, how naive trust in the systems that we are taught are supposed to operate in this country. You know, I have great sympathy and empathy for such people because I, too, grew up a staunch believer in the U.S. government and our way of life. You know, liberty, justice, equality. And the reason that's important is because those ideals, not just American ideals, by the way, but human rights ideals, are actually worthy of a struggle and fight and pursuit. And what our job has to be is to say, yes, we could live like that, but not under a corporate capitalist economic system where we really have an oligarchy masquerading as a democracy. And that's the point I really want to make, is what this whole sort of affair is exposing is how the system actually operates, how it serves to undermine anyone who questions the systemic nature of how corporate capitalism and white supremacy actually operate in this country. And it's up to we, the people, to find ways to unite and fight this system. Because I'm not trying to fight to save this current dying system. I'm fighting to create an entirely new system.
John Kiriakou, the FBI had a John Kiriakou task force.
They sure did.
And the reports that they put out and they sent to the media or leaked to the media were such that you were telling me that even your wife could hardly recognize you in some of that coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that real quick.
Yeah, this is what the FBI does. They selectively leak information to make you look bad, but not just to make you look bad. They do it also to pollute any potential jury pool. So you can't speak to the media, right? Because anything you say in public can be used against you in court. And so you're silent. And that way the media only gets the FBI's slanted, skewed side of the story. So this is what they do. They just leak and leak and leak. And you can't possibly get a fair hearing in court.
Yeah. Dave Lindorf, there was the Church Committee hearings against FBI and CIA abuse. That was during the height of the mid-60s as a consequence of all of the exposures of COINTELPRO. Those of us who were in the movement, the political anti-war, anti-racist movement earlier, knew something was going on, but we didn't know its name was COINTELPRO or counterintelligence program. There were reforms and there was new limitations supposedly on the FBI and certainly on the CIA in terms of domestic surveillance. But I have to tell you, the Center for Investigative Reporting, after the 1985 second inauguration of Ronald Reagan, contacted me and said that I had been the target of an interagency, including the FBI, investigation launched by Oliver North because I was the spokesperson for a counter-inaugural protest on January 1985. Because my picture happened to be in the Washington Post with some sort of whatever comment about Ronald Reagan, they launched an interagency counterterrorism or whatever investigation. And the Center for Investigative Reporting showed that these guys were tailing me and reporting on me and my friends and family for a long time until FBI agents reported it. Apparently, that's how it came up through the FOIA request because they were complaining, one, it was so boring to watch us. And two, they were complaining that it violated the 1976-77 church reforms or the reforms that came in 1978. We have this is an enduring problem. In other words, it was in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, all the way back to J. Edgar Hoover and the Palmer raids in 1918, 1919. But it seems to me to be with particular venom and particular impact right now because we are in the era of the surveillance state. We have about 2 minutes left. Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, no, in 2004, I'm sorry, 2006, when I published my book, The Case for Impeachment, about the Bush-Cheney administration, I started, and I was doing a lot of travel to Taiwan and Hong Kong at the time because I had a Fulbright. Every time I would get on a plane, I would get searched, you know, with my bags taken aside, everything taken out. And I noticed I was getting this S with a circle around it on my boarding pass every time I do a boarding. And I asked the next time when I got one, why are you putting this on here at the counter? And she said, oh, I can't tell you that. Your name just shows up here. And that went on for about a year. Even when I traveled with my adopted son, who's Chinese, we would both get searched. And that lasted a year. There was no reason for that other than, you know, I mean, that was the only thing.
No, I hear you.
I had done.
Let's give Dave.
Writing a book.
Yeah, gotcha. Let's give Dave Cobb the last word. Dave Cobb, 45 seconds.
All I'll say is this. I appreciate that Loud and Clear exists in order to actually tell the truth about what's going on. And I'm encouraging listeners, no matter, it's great to get educated, but you've got to get active. I mean, we're going to have to both get out in the streets. We're going to have to build institutions, but we're also going to have to be willing to disrupt this system or it's going to continue.
Yeah. And John Kiriakou, those are good words because we want people to hear us. We want people to learn as much as they can that's not coming through the corporate-owned media.
That's right.
That's why alternative media is important. But ultimately, people make the decisions about whether society changes because what they do makes all the difference. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf. He's an investigative reporter, a columnist for Counterpunch, and a contributor to Business Week, The Nation, Extra, and Salon.com. You can find his writings at thiscan'tbehappening.net. And we've been joined by David Cobb, campaign manager of the 2016 Jill Stein Ajamu Baraka presidential campaign. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.